What's up? This is Movies On Up, discussion episode Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. I am your host, Ryan, so that would make Dave the tailor to my Leslie Vernon.
Yes.
That was the girl.
Oh, yeah, Taylor Gentry.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right, character
I thought
names.
You meant, like, I was creating your clothes.
No, although that is what a tailor does. Actually, I guess you could be my Ahab.
Yes, I know that term.
You're the good to my evil. This is our 101st episode, our first episode of October for this year. We are recording this on October 1st, so I feel like I can say that. This entire month, we are going to focus completely on horror movies. Every discussion episode we do is going to be on one of our favorite horror movies, or maybe not favorite, as it comes to next week. And all of our list episodes this month are going to have a horror theme. To kind of get that started off with our first discussion episode of the month, it will be Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, which is a movie that Dave and I both love. We both talked about it ad nauseum last year in October, probably three or four times
a
piece.
It came up a lot last October, and it's such a good movie, and we both love it, so we thought, what better way to kick off Halloween this year than with this one?
Not a better way at all. We usually like to kick off our episodes with a tagline. For this week's, it is, "For the Honor of a King and the Destiny of a Country." If you think you know what movie that tagline comes from, feel free to send your guess to us in an email, moviesonup@gmail.com. You can tweet your answer directly at the tailor to my Leslie Vernon, Mr. Dave Bisella, @moviesonup on the Twitter, or you can leave your guess on our Facebook page, which can be found at facebook.com/moviesonup/, get it? If you are correct, and if we choose you, you can win a prize package that will be full of all sorts of Halloween-themed goodies and maybe some not-so-Halloween-themed goodies. One of our listeners was nice enough, in celebration of our 100th episode, to send us some goodies. So we would like to thank him publicly at this point and maybe incorporate some of the stuff into future prize packages. Who knows?
Yeah, thanks to Russell from, I hope I pronounce this right, Maja Soaps. It's M-A-J-A, and it's M-A-J-A Soaps. .com. He sent us a nice little unisex care package with some soaps and some body balm, some foot cream, some powder.
I'm going to call this unisexy because these smell pretty nice.
The studio smells a lot better today than usual.
It does. And I'm hoping that it's not that Russell didn't send us this stuff tongue in cheek because he's like, boy, your show really stinks. So you guys could use some soap. Or you guys say a lot of bad words. So I'm going to wash your mouth out with lovely smelling soap at the very least. So thanks again, Russell. We appreciate it. I'm sure Dave and I will be lathering all of our parts with your gracious gift. So
yep.
Thanks.
MAJASoaps.com.
Check it out. If you want to smell nice, if you want to smell right.
If you want to smell like Ryan and I in the future.
That's exactly where I was going with it. If you'd like to smell like our nether parts, check out MajaSoaps.com. I guess back to the tagline, we'll go from plugs to tags.
Ironically, that was not a clean transition.
No, it wasn't. And that's probably why, again, with the soap, boy, you guys really stink at your jobs that you don't get paid for. But the tagline for this week that kind of got us off on that tangent, "For the Honor of a King and the Destiny of a Country." If you get that correct, that will be for some sort of prize package. Again, send your guess any of the ways that I have already described. If you forgot what they were, just rewind the podcast. You can do it. Once you download it, you can rewind.
Or stick around till the end. We'll go over it again.
Yeah, we'll probably give you the ways to get a hold of us at the end. Dave, it is past time for the tagline, but what time do you have over there?
It's time for a Halloween
bonus. Top five Scott Wilson movies. Scott Wilson.
Eugene.
Eugene, you may know him as Eugene, or probably more of you know him as Herschel from Walking Dead. He is Eugene in this film. He plays other characters in the following films. Number five, The Host. Number four, Young Guns 2. Number three, In Cold Blood. Number two, Clay Pigeons. And number one, not a surprise at all, it is The Way of the Gun. I feel like there's got to be a Way of the Gun discussion episode that's coming here shortly. We talk about that every week.
Yeah. That and Out of Sight.
That, Out of Sight, Dark Star 6.
Deep
Star 6. Oh, whatever. I don't know. Dark Star is a John Carpenter movie.
It's his first full-length movie.
Yes, that I came across in my research for, spoiler alert,
comedy.
Our John Carpenter list, which will be coming later this week. But without further ado, Let's get into Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon. Came out in 2006, directed by Scott Glosserman, written by Glosserman and David J. Steve, starring Nathan Basil, Angela Gothel, Zelda Rubinstein, Robert Englund, and of course, Scott Wilson. Domestically, it grossed $69,136, $38,000 coming on its opening weekend, which was March 16th of 2006. It opened on 72 screens, managed about $534 per screen, came in number 57 in the box office its opening week.
I have like a personal connection with this film because we saw I live with listener Jason West at the time, and we saw the trailer for this either late 2004 or sometime in 2005. It was a long time before the movie came out, and we waited for it. I did Google searches on it all the time. I actually emailed Glosserman, who had gotten back to me saying, like, hey, we're trying to get Distro. Like, there was some communication there. They just couldn't get it out. And then it came out a week before Jason West got married, and I remember me and him drove up that weekend to see it. And there were, like, two other people in the theater. But it was worth the wait. And to this day, I still absolutely love it.
I don't mean to disparage it by saying the box office numbers, because it really doesn't matter. This is absolutely the definition of a cult film. And we're hoping to put some more money in Mr. Glosserman's pocket by extolling its virtues over the next, I don't know, 35, 40 minutes. But because it's something that I like to do, Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon ranks in at number 9,466 on the all-time domestic gross film list. Dave, can you guess the movie that ranks directly behind it?
Made in Cleveland.
No, Intruders from 2012. And the movie number 9,465.
Home Invasion.
I've never heard of it. It is called The Red Balloon White Mane. That is a reissue from 2007. Whatever. Just because we always do it, that's where this one ranks. But much better. I feel like it's a much better movie than it gets credit for. I kind of describe it as like Spinal Tap, but a slasher version of This is Spinal Tap. It's not a mockumentary, but it's definitely set up as a fake documentary.
It's set up as a fake documentary. It does the District 9 thing, where I hate found footage, but District 9 started off as a documentary at first and then transitions when the time is right. This, 75...
Two-thirds.
Two-thirds of it, 67%, are a documentary. And there's some stuff cut in. There are some scenes that aren't done that way, but then it just goes into a straight slasher movie. And the style's awesome. The style is fantastic. But what it is, the Spinal Tap comparison makes sense, but I look at that. This is a love letter to horror fans. Like, this movie is just, like, made for people who love Jason and Freddy and Mike, who grew up on those movies and love them. And it's, like, it's tongue-in-cheek. It's, I'm not going to say a spoof, it's a send-up of them, but done in a serious tone.
It's done in a loving way.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense. I mean, it's not a spoof. It takes kind of the things that, as horror fans, we all recognize and sometimes feel like we can guess what's going to happen next, because there are tropes in horror movies, and this movie isn't the first to point those out, but it does it in kind of a unique way. And I think you kind of hit the nail right on the head when you said, you know, guys that grew up with Freddy and Jason, the way this movie presents itself is, you know, that these guys are real and they all inhabit the same world. When Taylor's first giving her introduction to the documentary, she mentions Camp Crystal Lake and Jason. She mentions Elm Street, and she's trying to get an interview with a big tall gentleman who lives on Elm Street, though he may be a guy from another horror franchise you may be familiar with.
Kane Hodder cameo, which is such a good cameo. Just, again, it was made for horror fans.
Absolutely. To have Kane Hodder not in Jason regalia, but, you know, kind of being there on Elm Street, on Freddy's home turf, is definitely a nod in several different ways. But at several points in the movie, it does talk about the work that guys like Fred and Jason and Mike and Chuck have all done. So that's just right at the beginning. You know that the tone of this movie, like, if you're a fan of horror, this is definitely for you. The point behind, you know, this documentary is, you know, you've got Leslie Vernon, who is about to try and become the next Jason or the next Michael Myers, and he invites this film crew to kind of watch him and interview him, so you can kind of get a glimpse behind the mask, so to speak. And one of the first things that you find when you meet Leslie Vernon is he's a really charismatic dude. Not at all what you would assume someone like Michael Myers or Jason is. He's a lot closer to Freddy than he is Jason or Mike Myers.
He wasn't like Rob Zombie's version of Mike Myers, where the minted kid, everything. Real fun, like hard to take serious and just real fun, like loves life, love what he does. Like this is his life's work that he's leading up to, and he's just excited to share it with somebody. And real charismatic, handsome, like just a fun Nathan Basil's performance was awesome throughout the entire movie, but like he hooks you that second he's on screen, and it's like, all right, I want to watch what this guy does. And it's just the way it was set up, is just how you meet him is so fun.
And when he's given the documentary crew a tour of his house, and he gets, one of the first things that I notice is he gets to his library and he says, "This is my pride and joy." And he starts talking about the books that he has. You know, it's things you would need to know, I guess, if you were going to be some kind of serial killer. You'd have to have a working knowledge of anatomy, so you know the easiest ways to kill people. And escapism, which I think, of course, escapism.
Again, that one's set up awesome. She's like, "Oh, are these more work-related?" He's like, "Well, I wouldn't suggest reading Grey's Anatomy for kicks." But then he's like, "These are the fun ones, David Copperfield." Then he does a magic trick to show, like, he's ahead of everybody in the room, and it's like, makes sense. Like, it's like, oh, yeah, you would need to study all that. And it's, I like that because it takes everything, the whole movie, like, I'm jumping the gun, but everything that you see Mike and Jason and, well, Freddy's a different story, but everything you see them do in their movies, like, this tries to answer it logically. Like,
how you would go about doing that.
And I thought that was brilliant, and I love the approach, and it's just that, like, he loves it so much, he just studies it. Like, this is his life's work.
Yeah, like any kind of job that you would have, you know, you have to learn all the skills that it would take to get good at it. And you see, you know, these, it comes across as supernatural when it's done by Michael Myers or it's done by Jason, but it's not supernatural. It's sleight of hand. It's escapism. And it kind of grounds that in reality, which I think is awesome. Something else that that Leslie does is essentially lay things out. It's a step-by-step process for him. And he kind of takes the film crew through all the steps. And step one is have an anchor for your legend. Jason's anchor was, you know, Camp Crystal Lake. Michael Myers had Haddonfield. We go to this ancestral home for Leslie Vernon, and they show you the apple orchard. And it kind of sets up his origin story, his backstory, which, you know, all good killers have. Everybody knows Freddy's, Jason's.
And I love this because this is one of three times you get his origin story. Because Taylor sets it up in her opening thing on the documentary. Like, she sets up what she found out from his research, or from her research. Now you have him tell it from his point of view, and then later in the library you get Zelda Rubinstein giving the urban legend story of it. So it's cool that it is heavy on the backstory, but all of those are slightly different, and it's just cool to say, like, okay, yeah, if this were real, like, not everybody's story is going to be the same. There's going to be different things. And I liked that that was such a subtle thing, but it played out perfectly.
We talked about skills and, you know, if you were a killer, the skills you'd have to have if this were real to be able to pull off the feats that he's hoping to pull off. One of the things that you'd have to be good at is cardio. He says, you know, you got to run like a freaking gazelle without getting winded. And that's absolutely true. I mean, we see it so many times, you know, whether it's Leatherface or, you know, whether it's Jason chasing kids through the woods or through wherever, and they never, you know, they never have to stop and throw up or hit the inhaler.
And that thing where they're running full speed and you got to make it look like you're walking. Like, I loved all of that. And then it shows the, like, him running when her back's to him and then walking when she turns around. Like, it's just such a funny, like, exchange, that whole cardio thing. It made sense. Like, I love that they're trying to make this logical and make this based in reality. And it was, like, a great breakdown of slasher movies.
And it's something that everyone has noticed, whether it's active or passive. You've noticed it. And when he brings it up, oh, of course, we've seen that 1,000 times. Just as a sidebar, your horror movie villains, do you prefer them to be, and I kind of think of zombies specifically, do you prefer them to be like the walker type zombies, or is it scarier if they can, you know, run like a freaking gazelle?
It depends on how they're set up. I didn't mind runners in 28 Days Later because it made sense. But like the dead returning and running, that doesn't make sense. True zombies, I like to be realistic. Like they're slow, they're not moving fast. But
how about your Jason Voorhees? Do you prefer him a runner?
I don't want him running.
Okay.
He ran in the trailer for the new one, and that made me not watch the remake.
He ran in the movie, too. They didn't cut that out.
Yeah, no need to see that.
He lumbered more than he ran. But that brings us to step two, which is find your target group. And he says, you know, it's not just about the girl. She's got to have a solid supporting cast as well as that one survivor girl. And as he's kind of pointing out groups, not necessarily his survivor girl, he's in a completely different town, just showing them, well, this is the kind of group that I would go after. You know, you got your jocks, your nerds. One of the things that I did love is the subtle nods. I mean, we already mentioned Kane Hodder on Elm Street, but as he's describing this target group, you see the twins wearing white, jumping rope, another nod to the Nightmare on Elm Street series. But there again, I mean, every horror movie that you've seen, you know, involving teens, you've got to have, you know, that cheerleader character, the jock character, the nerd, the drug user.
And it's funny because the characters in these movies are so cliched, but yet when you just
archetypes kind of
when you go look at a high school, they're just looking at a high school. It just looks like a normal high school. Yeah, your stoners are over here, your jocks, your virgin girl. Like, yeah, there's other people around, but there are those archetypes everywhere. So that was an awesome, like, just everything that was set up about this movie, like, oh yeah, it does always seem to center on a girl. That's who we go after. That's our survivor girl. And it's because that's a common cliche used in horror movies. Laurie Strode, Nancy, like,
yeah, not just, you know, in the slasher genre, but, you know, you've got Ripley with Alien. I mean, there are, you know, that strong feminine character that oftentimes does end up being virginal. Maybe that'll come into play here a little bit later.
This tackles a lot of that too. Like, go back when he's walking him through the apple orchard, he touches on, you know, it's like he touches on stuff like male and female throughout. Like, it gets into it heavier later, but
yeah,
he's already
that,
made
I made a note of it then.
Yeah, he makes hints of it along the way. So
one thing that does become pretty obvious is that it takes a lot of planning to be a killer. It's not just, hey, I'm gonna rise from the dead and kill a bunch of people. There's a lot of preparation that has to go into it. And there's a lot of preparation you see in step three, which is the flyby. It's that first jump scare that you get in a movie. This movie actually starts with a horror scene type version of the flyby. When the movie switches back and forth from documentary, when it's not a documentary, it's presented like it's a slasher movie. And that's how the cold open of this movie is. It's with their filmed version of this flyby. Again, that's something that we all know from these movies. It's that first jump scare you get before anybody dies. But like Leslie says, it just lets the girl know that she's in for some trouble.
Yeah, and I mean, the beginning of the movie sets the tone of a slasher movie. It's traditional, door slam, she sees him, oh, he's not there. And then this scene takes you beat by beat how that's done. Oh, there's string on the brick. It's awesome. Like, we talk about,
she's going to take a couple steps forward. You're going to pull the string.
We talk about, like, movies teasing you at the beginning. Like, Jurassic Park's always my example. Like, you see the dinosaur's eye at the beginning. And this was that little, Insidious was another one. This was a little tease at the beginning because it's hard to get into that world if you just start with Taylor as the documentary, right? So just that little tease, and then to have it come full circle, like right here, I thought was awesome.
And it's also, you know, when they're doing the flyby, this is the first time, you know, you see a car show up. And it's just, it's a real quick line. And they cut away from it as soon as, it's one of the documentary guys says, like, who the fuck is this guy? And then just snap, we're on to the next thing.
I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. No idea, but it doesn't matter. It's completely irrelevant. On to the next thing. And the next thing is Scott Wilson. It's Eugene, the retired killer. We meet Eugene in a sensory deprivation tank because, you know, you need to have full control of your bodily functions if you're going to be a supernatural killer.
Yeah, he's buried in a box for 3 days, and they just wake him up.
He's like, oh, is it, what time is it, 6 o'clock on Tuesday? No, Thursday. You've been in here for 3 days. But he mentions that, you know, you've got to be able to slow your heartbeat down so that you can appear dead. And how many times, you know, that's one of the biggest tropes in horror movies is that the killer looks like he's dead. And you know some doofus is going to go over there and check it out. Surprise, killer's not dead. Well, this is, I guess, how you would appear dead if you have that sensory deprivation training to be able to, like the yoga guys, Leslie says in the movie, to be able to control yourself to give off that illusion, at least, that you're dead.
Yeah, but the whole conversation with Scott Wilson and his wife Jamie, it's fun because this is he compares how it used to be, like the early essentially slasher movies before slasher movie was really a thing, and then how like Mike and Jason and Freddy changed the game. And I thought that was an awesome like nod and a throwback, and like it sets up that, oh yeah, this world doesn't just have Freddy and Jason and Mike, like those are just the legends. There's all these other slashers that maybe don't have the household name of them.
The guys that, you know, maybe knocked over a sorority house and got themselves killed or got themselves busted. But I'm glad you bring up the conversation they had, because he talks about it's all about the quantity of work in the 60s and 70s. And I wasn't sure. At that point, I don't think it's as much, you know, the sequels that he's talking about. I think it's just about how many you kill in just one specific movie, and then that's it, your career is done. But whereas, you know, the slashers maybe post 1980 with Friday, when they really became what we're, you know, used to seeing, you know, when they did become legends by coming back and continually having you know, I guess careers that spanned a decade, which made those guys
and
legends.
That's what he says, is it was you kill as much as you can, so you're doing a couple a year, whereas they got, once they, you know, these guys were doing it once every year or once every couple years, and that's what made them legends.
I mean, this whole scene is full, you know, of a lot of how you might construct a horror movie. And one of the final things that gets brought up right is they're ready to leave Eugene's house, is his wife mentions the red herring and how, you know, he's going to have to find his red herring, and he's kind of, and that's the first person that gets killed that's not really someone in the close friend group, in the target group, so to speak, of your survivor girl, but somebody that's kind of on her periphery to kind of let her know that something's coming. And one of the things that, one of my favorite red herrings of all time is Drew Barrymore in Scream. I remember before that movie came out, everybody knew that she was in it. She was in the trailers.
She was the biggest name at the time in that movie.
Yeah. So, spoiler alert, when they kill her, like 10 minutes into the movie, you're shocked.
Her death is the cold open, essentially.
Yes, absolutely. And nobody saw that coming, but it is the best example of a red herring. I can't think of a better example. And, you know, they do mention it in this one and how it's, you know, you don't want to kill a friend because that'll turn the heat up too soon. It just explains, you know, why you know, as a killer, why you would want to have that sort of first strike, I guess.
Yeah. And just this whole thing with Eugene, the whole scene is awesome, because we talked about when you first meet Nathan Basil, you meet Leslie Vernon, real charismatic, real fun guy. Scott Wilson, similar. Like, he's not, you know, in a psychiatric ward. He's just a fun-loving, like, a young, hot wife, like, just energetic. One of my favorite lines that came right before the setting up the red herring was Taylor asks him, like, why? Like, why do you guys do this? And that's what I love about this movie, is it's so spot on, but it's also very well written. Scott Wilson's line is, for good to be pitted against evil, you have to have evil. So these guys aren't just killing because they want to kill. It's not some sick thing for them. They feel like they're doing the world like a service, which I think is cool. Like, they're being evil because the world needs evil, which I thought was really like a cool way to look at it.
And I think you've heard that even from comic book villains before. I want to say the Joker's mentioned that at some point to Batman, is that, you know, you have to have kind of the, or maybe it was Two-Face, maybe it was the opposite
Satan
side of the coin.
In a South Park movie.
Sure.
Without good, without evil, there could be no good, so it must be good to be evil sometimes. Like, it's just always a fun, like, little way to look at it from villains. And
you're absolutely right. And, you know, we talked about having to have that flip side of the coin. We meet the flip side of Leslie Vernon while he's attempting his, well, I guess he doesn't attempt. He does manage to whack Zelda Rubinstein, who is the red herring in this film. You meet Robert Englund, who is playing the psychiatrist. Dr. What's
Doc Holloran.
Doc Holloran. Yeah, very close to the character from Halloween. Very, very close. But I thought it was neat that Freddy shows up as the flip side of the coin.
And Zelda Rubinstein in there. So, like, is it, this movie's made for horror fans.
Oh, yeah,
like,
definitely. Doc Holloran is the Ahab, as Leslie calls him. And he couldn't be more excited that he's got an Ahab. He's kind of got that Batman to his Joker, that flip side of the coin, to make things that much more interesting. You know, it's one thing to just set this all up and kill a bunch of teenagers, but when you have a guy that's actively trying to stop you, knows what you are, you know, then it kind of does put you in that category of a Michael Myers.
Yeah, and they describe the Ahab as the embodiment of everything good. So you do have that good versus evil. It's not just evil versus scared. You get the good element in there. And who else better than Robert Englund to do that?
It's fun to see him, you know, on the other side of the knives, so to speak. We find out shortly thereafter that, you know, there is sort of a code of ethics to being a killer, and that is the closet. When somebody goes in the closet, why don't you just, you know, rip the door off and kill them? We've seen that, and I think in every horror movie in the world ever, somebody's hidden in a closet. And very rarely do they get killed in said closet. Well, why is that? Well, it's because the closet symbolizes the womb. So it's a protective zone. It's off limits to killers. One of my favorite lines in the movie is right as soon as Leslie's explaining why he can't kill anyone in the womb, Taylor says, oh, so you're pro-life.
Yeah, it's like the womb where we're most innocent. Oh, so you're pro-life. Just the exchange there is so...
A pro-life serial killer show.
Yeah, and it's a fun exchange. And one of my favorite things, we haven't really talked about performances a lot, but the Angela Gothels, her performance in this, I think was awesome because she looked like a college, like, filmmaker journalism student because she's her off-camera and her on-camera were two completely different things. And I thought that was funny and kind of, I don't know, I took it as kind of a shot to journalism in a way because, like, she turns it on and, like, tries to be extra serious and everything on camera. And I thought how she managed to go between the two, I thought was perfect. Like, I really liked her performance in this.
She kind of reminded me a bit of, I forget her name, from The Bay, another movie that was kind of, it was definitely found footage, and it was, the bulk of it was a college student putting together a documentary. But they were both very much, very earnest at the start of it, whether they were just covering some pageant in a small town or putting a documentary together on a guy who's about to kill a bunch of people. About to kill everybody, because that is rule number one as a killer. Nobody gets away. Not a one. This is when he gets to his house, and he really starts in graphic detail laying out how he's going to kill everyone and how no one's going to get away. You know, you're going to start the killing with people that have sex, the boot knockers. And it's something that, you know, I mentioned Scream again because Wes Craven did a really good job of this when Matt Lillard is talking about, you know, the ways to survive a horror movie. It's don't have sex. It's don't say, I'll be right back. It's all the things he did. You know, we're getting it in this movie from the mouth of, well, I guess, spoiler alert, you were in Scream too. But you're getting it from, you know, a masked killer before he does it. And he lays it out. He says, we're going to start by killing the people that are having sex. Then we're going to stage the bodies to try and not let everybody break containment too soon. You know, we're going to rig the fuses, put some dead batteries in the flashlights, which, again, is something you see all the time in horror movies. Boy, why do these flashlights never work? You find out why cars never work, because, you know, he's taking the precaution, taking the planning to take the spark plugs out. He just sets up the entire scene that's going to play out a bit later in the movie, but meticulous detail.
And one thing I love, it's kind of like just a throwaway, is he's talking about, like, oh, you saw the branches, so if there's a tree close to the window and they try to get, that'll fall, and how he nailed the window shut because you want to cut down exits. And he says, well, won't people just break the windows? And he's like, you would think so, but they really
but
don't.
No. Like, yeah.
And it's funny because then you instantly in your mind start going to horror movies, and it's like, oh, yeah, they really don't.
Like, no, they only really do it, and he'll mention it. Like, they only do it on the second floor when they're on the roof. And then when you're on the roof, you're screwed.
Yeah.
this is kind of where he starts talking about this idea of the shed that they had, where he wants to get his survivor girl to make her way to the shed where she can get some kind of a weapon to try and fight him. And these weapons are all, he's done a good job of trying to rig them as best as he can so he doesn't get killed. But he mentions that they are phallic in nature. And that's when, you know, the woman has empowered herself with a phallus to try and fight him.
At the end, I want to go over my favorite Leslie Vernon lines, because there's so many good one-liners. But this one, I'm going to spoil it and just say it right now. He just says, she's empowering herself with cock. Like, he's comparing, like, an axe, a sledgehammer. Like, these are the main weapons you see that are very phallic. And I just love the way he delivers that line. She's empowering herself with cock. It's so funny how he says it. His delivery is so funny.
All this planning that he's put into it, whether it's, you know, you loosen the head on the sledgehammer so the head falls off, or you take the edge off of, you know, some of the bladed weapons. Yeah, I guess it's not cheating, it's preparation. That all these coincidences, oh, the car never starts. When you look at them as coincidences, it's frustrating. But if you think of it in terms of, oh, no, this guy just planned all this out, then it becomes kind of cool. He's some kind of super genius, instead of just being like, these poor saps have the worst luck in the world.
And you get that. Like, you see how well planned out it is. And he's saying beat for beat what's going to happen. So later, when things aren't going exactly how he said they were, but things have changed, you know, oh, he knew these things were going to change, and he's still so far ahead of everybody. So it's like, it sets it up that if you're playing chess against this guy, you're not going to win, because he's so many moves ahead of you. And that's how they always are. They're always right around the corner. They're always everywhere.
Yeah, what comes off, what may come off as luck for Leslie Vernon, it is preparation. That's what it's all about. He's made his own luck by nailing the windows shut, by taking care of all the things that just seem like, oh boy, these guys can't catch a break. It's because he's already thought of it. He's already thought about your move, what you would do, and he's countered it so that you do exactly what he wants you to do.
Because he studied these people.
Right.
It's not just a random group of kids. He's studied them.
Talked about, you know, empowering yourself with cock. One of my favorite lines, and I hope I'm not stealing yours, is after he says, okay, I want to get her out of the shed, and then, like, the piece de resistance, you know, I want her to go into the orchard, you know, where we're going to have our final showdown. You know, he said, okay, if the weapons are the phallus, like, what does, you know, the orchard represent? And Taylor says, well, it's, you know, the birth canal. And he said, yeah, it's yonic.
Yonic, opposite of phallic. It's girl parts.
Girl parts, exactly.
Add that one down there, too.
I absolutely loved that. And it is, I'm not sure if when people actually write this stuff, you know, maybe the phallus is just built into our man brains. But I think the whole birth canal might be reading a little bit too much into it. And I think that's what they're having fun with at this point, where, you know, you've got your womb in the closet. She's empowered herself with a phallus, and now she's being reborn by traveling through this
And
birth
that's
canal.
That's what I mean, that I touched on earlier, is that it's very, how many slasher movies have the male lead that's like your guy? Because nobody, who cares about that? Like, you want to see this weak girl become strong by defeating this monster, and it's all fairly chauvinistic if you look at it that way. And that's kind of, after she says pro-life, or during that same interview, she's like, oh, so you're pro-life and a chauvinist. And it's like, yeah, there is something very sexist to, we're targeting the women because they're weak.
Because then, they're vulnerable.
And then we're surprised when they come out strong, pretty much. And so, I mean, there is, whether it's intentional or not, that's just how the nature has happened. That, yeah, they are. If you want to break them down, they are pretty sexist.
How do these women survive? We get a little bit of advice from Eugene before things really get kicked off. He kind of gives you 3 points on how to survive an encounter with somebody like Leslie, or himself back in the day. Don't hang out with a virgin. If you do have a virgin in your friend mix, either get her laid or get the hell away from her. And then I guess if we would have done favorite Eugene lines, this probably would have been mine. Yeah. Run like a motherfucker. Don't try to hide.
They will find you.
Right. Don't try and fight. Just pick a spot ahead of you. Run in a straight line as fast as you can. And don't look back because you're not going to like what you see. And it is absolutely perfect. How many times you see people look back and trip?
Yeah.
It's like, no, just run. Just get the hell out of there. And that's what we yell at the movie screen. Like, yeah. No, don't investigate that sound. Just get the hell out of there. And he says, you know, that's what you got
to
do.
And Taylor asks, like, in all the movies, it's always like, well, we should stick together. And she is in that. She's like, so what about sticking together? And he says, sure. If there's somebody slower than you in the group. Like,
for when it's time to run and listen to my advice.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, and then that whole scene, it's set up that Eugene's wife was his survivor girl. It's alluded to pretty much.
Yeah. She was a fast runner, but she caught him.
Yeah.
And then we do go to the house to officially get the business started off. And the business gets kicked off when Leslie makes, it's not his first kill, because at this point he's killed Zelda Rubinstein. They filmed that. But when he kills the couple having sex, he waits for him to actually get going.
Not a bad way to go out.
Right. As kind of a courtesy. Like, if you're gonna die, you might as well die making it with somebody. And I guess, wouldn't we all like to go out like that, I suppose.
But even before this, I liked the makeup. Like, he's going through, like, oh, this is something fighters use to stop the bleeding. This is flame retardant, all this stuff.
And it makes you look pale.
Yeah, it makes you look pale, like, all that stuff. And then those first two kills are off screen, and it's then that Taylor and Doug and Todd, the cameraman, finally realize, like, oh, this is real. Like, this is happening.
And that's kind of where the fake documentary ends. There's 27 minutes left in the movie. It's pretty much the end of Act 2. But from here on out, it does become a slasher movie. We don't have that motif of Taylor and the crew anymore. They're still around. They've made the decision that they have to let these people know what's about to happen to them. And since they know the plan, they can defeat
him. And I love how this whole transition is made, because he comes back in after the kill, sees the look on her face, walks him to the van, basically says, you're done. You have that look in your eyes. You have that we can't let this happen look. So he basically is kicking them out, then comes back. We're not going to see each other, does a goodbye. The exchange with him and Taylor there, one of my favorite lines we could do later, but it's such an awesome exchange because it shows that, like, he does care about these guys. Like, he let them in. He shared his world with them. And, yeah, he is kind of bummed to see him go, but he's got work to do. His relationship with them isn't as important as what he's planned to do, and it's so subtle, but he says, you have that we can't let this happen look. And then as soon as he walks away, she says, we can't let this happen. Todd or Doug, I forget which one, says, he said you were going to say that. So it shows that he's a step ahead of them even. And she's like, shut the cameras off. And then it switches at the line. The documentary is over. And then now we're just in a straight slasher movie. And I love that transition, is that ends with them putting the cameras in the van with the line, the documentary
literally
is over.
Yeah.
Yeah. And now you're just straight slasher movie. There's no more mockumentary. There's no more just slasher movie here.
And I think as a slasher movie, they had pretty much already constructed not exactly how this slasher movie is going to play out, but very, very similar with some variances. Now, obviously, once the crew puts themselves in the middle of Leslie's plan, they find out that really they've been in the middle of it the whole time.
They've always been part of the plan.
Right. His relationship with them is very special because they're actually the target group that he's been looking at the entire time. You kind of get that switch, and it's hinted at. But I think when they bust in on the survivor girl,
the virginal Kelly,
and she's going reverse cowgirl on the nerd.
That ain't no virgin.
No, no. She's done this a time or two before.
So you're kind of... That's when you kind of the seed is planted that, oh, Taylor must be the survivor girl. Like, and then it's revealed she is. She's
certainly
a virgin.
She is. Yeah. As a slasher movie, how do you think that it does, you know, stack up against the multitude of slashers that it has referenced to this point?
I liked it a lot because they set it up like it's almost two slasher movies. It's here's how it would have happened without you three in the picture.
Yes.
He goes through the kills, there's tits, like it's this, like all
gratuitous.
This stuff, gratuitous. It's like it goes through all this stuff of how it would have happened now that they're there, And so now they're expecting all of that to be the plan. So it set it up where you've already seen a lot of it, but now there's still surprises. And one thing this movie did awesome is a lot of foreshadowing and just, I mean, he makes reference to the post-hole digger.
What if two guys show up at the cab or at the shack? Then what happens? Well, one of them's going to get it with a post-hole yeah, digger.
And he does. And just stuff like that, it set him up as a really good slasher because you knew who he was. And the Todd, the bigger, I forget the Todd.
The fat one, Todd,
when he chases him down and, you know, he's on him and Todd's like trying to reason with him. Like, dude, it's me. Like, he takes his mask off so he can look him in the eye. And it's like, dude, it's, you know, and you realize like, oh, he's a person. Like, this isn't a supernatural being. This is a guy that just.
He's just a man.
10 minutes ago was saying goodbye to him and seemed like he really cared about him. And then he kills him. So it's just like, I liked that because now not only was Todd scared, but he was scared because it was a guy that 10 minutes ago he considered a friend almost. Like, I thought it was really good because the kills were still fun. There was still some good dialogue in there. The Kelly death was funny because she was your survivor girl. Overall, I felt the entire movie, I think Robert Englund was kind of underused.
Yeah.
That would be my only like critique of the movie. But in a way, he was used perfectly because you don't want to – it wasn't his movie.
Right.
And it's hard to put Robert Englund in a movie without him being – it being his movie because he is so – especially in this genre, he's so charismatic and he steals scenes. And it was Nathan Basil's movie. So once it became a slasher, I liked it still, even though – because you didn't really know what was going to happen, even though you were told what was going to happen. But
very specifically, yeah.
Yeah, I thought it was – I thought it was really good, and then everything, I mean, I love the movie, and everything carried over. Like, the acting I thought was great, because Basil, you see that other side of him, and, you know, you got a glimpse of his anger after she goes in to talk to Kelly at the diner, and he chokes her, and he's that's the first time you see that rage. But then, like, he's happy to see her again after he tells them they can leave. It's cool that you knew him as a person, and then you knew them, but... he was so good. Like, this is a movie star performance. I saw this and thought, Nathan Basil's going to have an awesome career. I don't know what's happened. Like, I don't know. He's doing a lot of production stuff, but I liked him on screen. I thought he was a fantastic in this role. I thought she was great. All the supporting was good. Like, even the victims. Like, I thought they were played well. So just all around, like, Glosserman did awesome with this movie.
You mentioned why did Basil not kind of blow up. I think that it is because this movie, as much as we like it, and it seems like the folks that we hang around with all really, really like it, I'm kind of afraid that not as many people on the whole really enjoy it or have seen it for
or
that matter.
Get it. That's what I wonder is how many people get it.
I think if you see it, you'll get it. I think the problem is just
the IMDb comments. I think you'll disagree with that.
Well, I guess that's the thing is I haven't. But I just feel like not a lot of people have really seen this movie. And I think that that's maybe evident when you look at, obviously, the movie is set up for a sequel during the credit sequence.
I wanted to get to that. I didn't know if you were done.
Yeah.
These are probably my favorite credits of any movie ever. Like, just... the way Psycho Killer comes in, like, that's such a good song,
yeah.
And it's so fitting. And it's the credits are rolling, and they're over morgue footage, and it's just...
and you know what's going to happen.
You know what's going to happen, but you're still just watching, waiting for it. He pulls out, you know, Vernon's body, and more guys just... and then at the end of the credits, he sits up. Like, you know it's happening, but it was just how it was done. It's such a slow burn to get to it, because you do wait the entire credits, and you know what's going to happen... but there's still that satisfaction when it happens. Like, I know it's coming, but I still just want to see it. I wanted a sequel to this movie so bad, and I still want a sequel to this movie so bad. I feel like for what's out there and what gets released in mainstream horror, especially from the slasher standpoint, this is on par with anything of the last, like, 20... since the heyday of The Nightmare and and the Jason. There's been no good, like, unique slasher movies to get a major release, really.
Yeah, maybe major release, definitely. But
no,
you,
I mean, there's been good slasher movies. I'm not saying that.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, if you point, you know, just specifically to this year, I think Hatchet came out about the same year. That's had two sequels.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen the third one yet, I don't think.
I couldn't finish the second one.
The second one was awful.
Yeah.
You know, a movie like that was able to get a couple sequels, whereas this one, maybe the second one would be awful too, but I guess I'd still like to see it.
As well written as this was, because this wasn't just a...
gore fest.
This wasn't just good by luck. And I mean, I liked the first Hatchet. I did, but it wasn't... I wouldn't go praise... I thought it was funny. I thought the kills were good, but I wouldn't praise how... well-crafted and well-written it was, where this I do, because I thought this was a really well-made movie, well-written movie, and I really liked it. It was so smart, and that's something I wouldn't accuse Hatchet of being.
No.
I don't know. I wish it could have found an audience, and I don't understand. I guess I look at it and how much I like it and how good it is to me, and I just don't understand how it didn't find an audience.
I think that's kind of the problem. And when you look at, you know, the sequel to this movie, which is – in the process of being made. Now, that's going to, apparently, it's going to be a long and slow process before we see Before the Mask, the return of Leslie Vernon. About a year ago, it had a Kickstarter campaign, which I wasn't aware of. As a fan of this movie, now I realize I'm not as active on the social media as a lot of people's grandparents, but I feel like I should have known about this. This is a Kickstarter that I would have given money to had I known about it. Now, the Kickstarter goal was $450,000. It managed $183,000. That's it. So obviously not even half its goal to get the sequel up off the ground. So I think that shows how small the audience for this movie is. And it agitates me that I didn't know about this Kickstarter, because I feel like, you know, if we'd have done this episode last year and been able to point people to a Kickstarter, now I'm not saying that our audience would have been able
to. We don't have $450,000 worth of listeners.
Yes, I agree. Not even if, like, all of our listeners gave $450,000, do we have that much. At least I feel like we could have helped. I feel like however many people we have.
I would have chipped in.
Yes, yeah, Dave and I would have, so that would have been $6 more than they had to start with. But one of the things that I think you kind of feel the same way is when we talk about movies that are a bit smaller, like when we talked about Smashed, you know, or any of these indies, which is what this was, we like to try and turn people on to maybe something that they haven't seen. And this would be a perfect candidate for it. And I just wish the Kickstarter was still going so that we could say, hey, if you really liked this movie, and we think that if you're listening to us, you probably will like the movie. You'll get it. You'll appreciate it for the same reasons that Dave and I do. And, you know, here's a Kickstarter thing that you can fund if you'd like to, because I certainly would have. But now it just, you know, I mean, I know they're selling some memorabilia from the movie on like a Facebook page or something.
I mean, Facebook.com/Before the Mask. That page is still, the most recent post was on September 26th.
Yeah.
So that page is still active, and go like it. Go say something on it. I want to see this movie.
I would think that having a failed Kickstarter might be sort of a downer for Glosserman and the guys that are trying to make this movie. But I think that if you like it, definitely let him know. You know, I'm sure he's probably active on the Twitter or where else. But, you know, find him, let him know you like the flick and that there are people that do want to see the sequel.
And like I said, I had some email correspondence with Glosserman before the movie came out. I've met Basil at a couple conventions. Really nice people that I want the best for. I want him to be a star. I want them to get the funding. So it just bums me out. That's the only thing that bums me out about this movie is I love the movie. I wish more people cared about it as much as I do, because it's that good.
And if we can help in any way, just kind of getting, whether it's 5, 10 more people that maybe listen to us but haven't seen it yet, then I will feel at least good about that, because I feel like of those 10 people that watch it, at least 8 of them are going to like it. And, you know, then they've got 8 fans that they didn't have yesterday.
But enough on the sad part. I want to go back to how good this one was. These are my favorite Leslie Vernon lines from the movie. Very early on, right after you meet him, they're talking about his turtles. Taylor mentions how they're very feng shui, and he says, yeah, plants and turtles. I only keep pets I can eat, which is such a throwaway line, but it's so funny. And then he takes him to the house and is talking about, like, that's where the legend, that's where the kid grew up. And she's like, oh, why don't you live here? He's like, I can't. Like, this is where my return is. He says, if I'm going to reappear, I can't exactly be seen mowing the yard. And he just kind of pushes her away. Like, it's a very playful just push, which is one of the funniest moments that I think in the movie. Like, just as a silly, kiddish push. And then there's something where he plants the story tying Kelly to his backstory. And she says, oh, so you made that up? He goes, yeah, we make up a lot of stuff. A lot of what we use is CGI, which I just thought was such a funny line. Because everything he says is so matter of fact and so, like, he's just saying it. Like, it's not really cracking a joke, except for when they're in the library. He's getting ready to go kill. He goes over the whole plan. And this, I laughed for probably 10 minutes straight.
This was one of the, like, if you donated to the Kickstarter, you would get a bumper sticker that said Paradise Lost. Funded it.
Because it's so, he just, he goes over this big plan on how he's about to kill this woman, and he sits, and just nowhere goes, Paradise Lost, reaches behind him, grabs the book, found it. Like, it's just so, like I wonder if that was
and
improvised.
And then just kind of runs away.
Yeah, like, I wonder if that was improvised, because it makes no sense there, and it's hilarious. And then they're talking about the apple grinder or the cider maker. Mm-hmm. And Taylor asks, like,
what's that for?
He's talking about how it's important. She goes, well, what's it going to do? He says, it's going to crush some apples, and then juice will come pouring out. Like, that's like one of the few times he actually cracks a joke. And then in his, like, goodbye to Taylor, I alluded to this one. This is such a good line where she's like, why are you doing this? Like, this wasn't your legacy. Like, you don't have to go through with this. And he's like, I made a choice to provide a counterbalance to all those things that we hold good and pure. You chose journalism. Just such a funny line. Like, and she even cracks a little joke, like a smile at that, even though the situation, like, it just, his delivery on all of these, like, it's just so good. And I love his performance. I love this movie. I love everything about it. I don't know if you've got that yet.
And then for our bonus watch this list, this is something that we started last year. We're going to continue it this year. Being that it is October, we're going to give you kind of 31 or how whatever the math works out to, a bunch of movies to watch this October. If you want to watch one, we have some friends that try and watch one every night. I can't do that because I spend most of my nights editing this podcast. But if I were going to watch 31 movies this October, I might start with a couple slashers, because that's what we're talking about today. Scott Wilson talks about guys that have had maybe just a one-off career. And one of my favorite one-off slashers is the original Maniac. It's, you know, got its reboot that I think it's in the can. I know it's in the can. It may be getting a DVD release here sooner than later, so you may even be able to watch the new one here pretty shortly. But go back and check out the original. I believe it was from 1980. Pretty good flick in the heyday of practical effects, which are near and dear to my heart.
I didn't go slasher, but I went another movie that Zelda Rubinstein appears in, Witchcraft from 2002, starring Michael Weston of Garden State. Kid gets a thing, can make wishes, but then terrible things happen. So it's one of those.
Be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, it's the epitome of a be careful what you wish for.
My last movie is one of those killers that did get a couple sequels, and obviously it's not Michael Myers. It's not Freddy. It is our good friend Angela from Sleepaway Camp. They made, the first one is far and away the best. If you haven't seen the original Sleepaway Camp, definitely check that out. Check out the sequels as well. I mean, they're not tremendous. I think you kind of get the picture after the first one, but it's camp slashers, and that seemingly is kind of a subgenre all of its own, but at least the first Sleepaway Camp, there is kind of something extra there for you to check out. So there's your first three. Our next episode that we've got coming up this week.
Next episode this week is our John Carpenter episode.
John Carter, yeah.
Yes, John Carpenter. We're going to go over our favorite John Carpenter movies. Spoiler alert, you probably can name our top three. Or at least
Dave's.
Yeah, because I didn't disqualify him like somebody. But that's later this week. If you want to get a hold of us, moviesonup.com, moviesonup@gmail.com, facebook.com/moviesonup. At Movies On Up on Twitter. You can find us on iTunes, on Stitcher, or you can find every episode at moviesonup.com. Let us know what you think. Let us know if you have suggestions for horror movies that you think are underappreciated or underrated. We got to come up with 31 watch this for this month. So we'll gladly take suggestions.
And, on the off chance that I haven't seen one of them, I would love to watch something.
Yeah, I'm always looking for new good horror movies that I missed or fell through the cracks or something. But you can find me personally on Twitter at Dave Pacella, DaveBacella.com. I do have another show, Eric and Dave Talking with Eric and Dave. We've been hiatus for...
Back from the dead.
Yeah, we've been on a hiatus for about 3 weeks. We will be back very, very soon, so keep an eye on for that, if you care.
If you don't care, keep an eye out for our next episode, which will be the John Carpenter episode coming at you here straight away. But until then,
keep it up.